The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the monthly guest Dharma series.
There is a sutta or discourse in the middle link connection called the Noble Quest, the Arya Paryasana. And I'm not going to talk about it a lot, but the basic theme it starts with is that we can have quests or projects or aims that are noble, and we can have quests, projects, aims that aren't so noble. And this suggests that discerning the difference is important. That sorting out, investigating what are noble pursuits and what are ignoble pursuits is part of the practice. And a theme that comes up in this discourse, which ties into what I want to stress tonight, is, and it's a theme that's very common in the very earliest Buddhist teachings, the theme here is for beings, and I'm paraphrasing, not quoting, beings that are entangled in birth, aging, illness, corruption, violence, which I slip in, it's not explicit in this one, but violence, aging, death, for the most part, pursue things that are subject to birth, aging, corruption, pollution, violence, aging, and death. And the critique that occurs in this discourse and elsewhere is, and it assumes something. It assumes that we want to do something about the dukkha, the distress of birth, aging, corruption, cruelty, violence, aging, and death. But even those who on some level want to do something about the distress of birth, aging, illness, death, and the like, and make some level of commitment to doing so, yet we often end up pursuing stuff that's going to bring more involvement with birth, aging, corruption, violence, illness, and death. And then this is a frame for a brief review of the Buddha-to-be process leading from investigating this to his awakening, and then the first stages of sharing what he learned from the awakening. So this notion of noble quest is a frame for if we're troubled by something, let's use the Pali word dukkha, which currently I translate as distress, suffering, distress, life that's off track. If we're troubled by distress and dukkha, but end up pursuing stuff that is subject to more dukkha. And in the Buddha's time, a primary way of talking about dukkha was birth, aging, loss, violence, illness, death, and a few other words sometimes get put in. It doesn't make sense. And so we want out of something, and yet we pursue the way out by seeking that which is just going to perpetuate. And so it's kind of, one of those little gerbil wheels. Even if we're very sincere and dedicated. This has been a theme that I've been pondering for a large chunk of this year, using it to keep reviewing what goes on in my life, how I use my time and energy, and what am I pursuing? I can give you my official Dharma teacher version. The kind of stuff you say that look good when you're up on the Dharma seat. But there's also, and not like I'm a total charlatan or anything, I hope. But then there's some other stuff going on that's might not be so noble. It's not particularly dastardly. Although I live in America, and that comes with a lot of baggage, which for me is a lot of the dukkha these days. But still, there's these things that when I look, maybe not the noble pursuits that I've officially signed up for. So I'm inquiring into this when I'm not distracted by being busy or some of the other stuff that I do. So I want to explore a piece of this noble quest tonight. I'd like to observe if it's my own perspective. You can check out how accurate it might be. There's something in the Buddha's quest, or properly the Buddha to be's quest. The term was bodhisattva, the awakening being. And so before the awakening, properly in early Buddhism, we don't speak of the Buddha. So the Buddha appeared with the awakening. Previous to that, we use the term bodhisattva, the awakening being, or I like to use the phrase the Buddha to be. There's something about the Buddha to be's quest that I think is universal. I don't know this. There's no, I'm not a practicing Muslim, for example, so I think it's no one can say, all paths lead to the same place. It's a nice New Agey idea. I kind of believe it, but I don't know. But so it's a belief that there's something about the Buddha's quest, and I like to think, again, I can't prove it, but I like to think that in all human beings, perhaps all life, this quest is operating. And at the same time, this is phrased in the terms and concepts of the Buddha's time and place. So tonight that will be important to, there's something universal in this, and it happens in a particular context. That is the lower Himalayas, what's part of Nepal now, and the Ganges Valley, and the culture of that time and place. Which, by the way, is not accurately described in most Buddhist stories, because those were based on later culture in that place, not actually what was probably going on in Buddhist time. But that's a whole other talk. So there's this universe. universal quest, I think, and it's expressed in the language of the Buddha's times, i.e., dukkha, and the escape from dukkha. And dukkha is often expressed in terms of birth, aging, and death. Often illness is included, and sometimes loss. And in other contexts, violence comes in. And sometimes words like defilement and corruption. That's all the dukkha side of things, the distressful side of things. So that's the phrasing of that commonplace. I still find it meaningful, but I hope we're all aware this is a fairly different commonplace, although we're still born, age, get sick, experience loss, and die. And there's still a huge, disturbing amount of violence in the human world. So what do we today, who to some degree are heirs of the Buddha's quest, make of his language and his quest? Some of us here tonight may not identify as Buddhists, but if we're in a place like this, doing some form of mindfulness, meditation, some forms of mindfulness meditation are being co-opted by Google, and the Marine, so I'm a little wary of that. But if it's, you know, one of the more better pedigree versions of mindfulness, such as taught here, and insight meditation practices along with metta and other things, then to that degree we're heirs of the Buddha. The more we study the teachings, take on other aspects of Buddhist practice, then we're increasingly heirs to the Buddha. And to that extent, we inherit the universal part of the quest. Although I would say just by being human, we inherit it. So a question I ask of myself and those who study with me is, okay, we're heirs to the Buddha's quest and the Buddha's, the awakening that grew out of that. How fully have we taken on this quest? And how deeply have we made it our own? How deeply have we digested it, assimilated it, and made it the guiding influence in our lives? To me, this is a daily question because I still catch tendencies to distract. I now live a mile from my internet connection, which has really helped in cutting down distraction. But still, I find ways to distract or just veg out and so on. So I ask this question daily, and the current form is to pick up a question that the Buddha, to me, explored. And the short version of this question, a little later I'll give you a longer version of it, is, what is the escape from dukkha? what is the escape from the dukkha that's exemplified by birth, aging, sickness, loss, corruption, violence, and that sometimes in Thailand, escape is translated as skillful escape because now, you know, Buddhists are accused of being escapists, and so some people are uncomfortable with the word, but it's as far as I know, the legit translation. Something has moved us to get involved in the practices we're doing and the study of the Buddha's Dhamma. And the framework from the Buddha's time to describe that is dukkha. Some distress has brought us to this. And whether we phrase it as escape from dukkha, it seems to me that that's the aim. It makes sense if one is disturbed by distress. We would like to find a solution. If you prefer that to the word escape. So that's a phrase that was current, it seems, in the Bodhisattva's Pali, or Sanskrit Sattva Pali, in that time, 2,500 years ago, more or less. And this phrasing has a context and background. I'm not a scholar of these things, but from a little bit of reading of what are scholars of what are called the Vedas, a dominant perspective of that time that clearly influenced the Buddha to be, though not necessarily the Buddha, and I'll get to that later tonight. But a major perspective of that time is each of us is fundamentally an Atman. Fundamentally, there is some unchanging essence that is our core. And if you want to know the details of the Brahmin beliefs about this, there are books to go into it. I don't believe it, so I'm not a good one to try to describe it. But there's a belief, what's relevant to tonight's talk, there's the belief, and this was philosophically developed in 100, 200 years before the Buddha to me, that fundamentally, at our core, there is an unchanging essence called Atman. And there are other names for it, the Purusha, the person. The seer is another one. And that the Atman takes on bodies, that is, reincarnates. And after death, triads, migrates, and reincarnates in another body. And this goes on and on and on. And so these Atmans keep getting trapped in bodies. And by the way, some of those bodies exist on, you know, astral planes, and it's not a physical body, like the kind of things we all around. But by embodying, reincarnating, then there's the Atmans once again get entangled in birth, aging, illness, corruption, loss, death. So Atmans go off and fall in love, get married, have kids, have farms, or open a business. Back in the Buddha's time, they might be a craftsman or a Brahmin priest, fishing or wandering hermit off in the woods. But too often they're pursuing things, to use the terminology of the time, gold and silver, wife and children, servants. I mentioned cattle was a baby, and so on. All of which are subject to birth, aging, illness, death. And so, just staying caught up in stuff that's subject to distress. And it seemed the Buddha to me accepted this framework. And that this was his starting point in when he entered on the wandering quest style of life, what were called samana at that time. This was the framework he started with. And then he saw various teachers, tried out various practices, and he came to the conclusion they didn't work. So the summary is, in his time and place, there was this belief that there's this atma that is our essential core that keeps getting trapped in bodies, birth, aging, illness, and death. And some theories have been proposed what to do about it, and they don't work, was his conclusion. And this then leads to what I now call the Buddha's big question, though it's properly the Bodhisattva's big question. There's a discourse called the Nagara Sutta, the city, where the Buddha, sometime much later, after the awakening, talks about weeks, probably, at most a few months, before the awakening. So this is after he had given up his heavy-duty ascetic pursuits, and decided to eat decently again, to bathe, and he found a pleasant place beside the Nirjara River near what's now Bodh Gaya in India. And he started to try a new approach. And much later he recorded this. Friends, before awakening, before I had fully awakened, while still a bodhisattva, this question occurred to me. Beings in this world experience hardship due to being born, aging, dying, passing away, and arising, or reappearing. When they are ignorant of the skillful escape, skillful means of escape from dukkha, as exemplified by aging and death, how will an escape from dukkha ever happen? I find a few very important and interesting things in this. So one, which I've already brought up, we keep, I think he's basically saying, we keep struggling with dukkha while we don't know the way out. So how are we ever going to find our way out? I think that's a good frame of the human dilemma. There's a lot in our lives that trouble us. And we struggle with it, and we don't know the way out. And he uses the word ignorance of the skillful means of escape. We have lots of of his hands. But he wanted the skillful one, the noble one that actually worked. Something here that's not quite explicit is, to some degree, he's copying to his own ignorance. There's a tendency in later Buddhism to turn the bodhisattva into, you know, a spiritual superhero. And in the kind of devotionalism that goes along with that, or the, you know, we got the Buddha, we got the best teaching or whatever, I think we overlook that there's the more difficult story of really grappling with the human dilemma and copying to ignorance. We're groping for an escape, but we're ignorant of what it is. So, and he had concluded that everything on offer in his part of the world at that time didn't work. And so how does he proceed? This, to me, is crucial if we also grapple with similar dilemmas. Here's how he proceeded after accepting, okay, we all want out of this dilemma, nobody knows how. Friends, the question then occurred to me, what is there such that there is aging and death? With what as condition is there aging and death? Rather than concoct a new theory, okay, that's a bit of work, here's my new theory, here's my new answer. He didn't just leap into another answer to grab onto. To me, this is a great piece of wisdom, because so often, you know, we're trying to grab at some answer. Give me the right practice. This is kind of the obsession in American Buddhism. Tell me how to do it right. There's a lot to unpack in that. In a way, it's, you know, give me the answer and I'll just do it and then it'll be all okay, right? Or at least I'll be a good whatever. Maybe not. Here, instead of proposing or grasping at another answer, he asks a question. So in that context, dukkha is associated with aging and death, or aging and death are a very vivid and major example of dukkha. When I was much younger, I didn't quite get that, but with every passing year and the death of more and more people I know, or things like typhoons and drone strikes and inner city violence and rural violence, this sinks in more and more, the dukkha of aging and death. So he takes that, instead of proposing an escape, he asks, what is there such that there is aging and death? What is the necessary condition for aging and death? What makes aging and death possible? And he pondered that and came up with an answer, which is birth. But I'm not going to dwell on answers right now, because he immediately proposed another question. Okay, aging and death happens because of birth. But what is there such that there is birth? what's the necessary basis for birth to occur. And he came up with becoming, or being, existence, the Pali word is bhava, which means being, existence, becoming. But he didn't take that as the solution. He answered, well, what's the basis of that clinging? What's the basis of that craving? What's the basis of that feeling, contact, and so on? If you've studied the dependent core rising teaching, this follows that formula. Now, I've come to wonder, maybe back then you didn't get the full official dependent core rising formula. And so what I've been focusing on is not the details that, okay, aging and death depends on birth, which depends on becoming. Because maybe that got worked out later. But what's more central, I think, to this is aging and death happens because of something. Which happens because of something, which happens because of something, which happens because of something. And he kept looking into things, and everything he looked into was conditioned by something else. And this is where the radical insight, I think, came from. The context of his time believed in atmans, fixed entities that don't change. But by asking, you know, notice in his questions, there's nothing about where is the atman, what is the nature of the atman, or the self, or the soul. There was no metaphysical, you know, what is the nature of this? What should the Atman do? Where does the Atman go? There weren't, he didn't indulge those speculations. But there's this dukkha that he was grappling with, as exemplified by aging and death. Okay, how does that come to be? What makes that possible? He kept looking and looking and looking. And in the words of one scholar, maybe others as well, as he kept looking into this, there was a shift in perspective, one that seems powerfully radical to me. The way of looking at life in terms of atmans that reincarnate in bodies and that goes on, believes in things that don't change. The atman, at least, is supposed to not change in most versions. There were debates about the notion of the atman, not Buddhist debates, but others. The assumption was there are these atmans that don't change. If we examine a lot of our behavior, especially what might be called ignoble quests, or at least distracting pursuits, we're usually looking for something. And our perceptions tend to be of a world filled with things. And we tend to perceive things as separate, as individual, and we often don't see or disregard or ignore how much each thing is connected to other things. I think just the way evolution did it, we perceive individual things that had great survival value, and then we came to see ourselves as individual things, and then eventually people ask, well, what part of us is the real part? In one corner of the world they call that Atma. So there's a way of seeing life as things. And things that are more or less separate, more or less lasting, we might debate, some last, some don't. But often in our pursuits, we're pursuing something as if it's going to last. You know, if I just get that new job, new this, new car, new relationship, new meditation practice, new jhana, new insight, you know, then I've got it. You know, and to get it and have it, it's got to be something that lasts. And there's got to be a you that's going to last to have it. And how much of our thinking and behavior is permeated by this? Now, the people in the Bodhisattva's time had thought carefully about some of this, so they believed a lot of things are just passing, don't last, and they're not going to satisfy our quest. But they still posited some things that do last. Our culture has, you know, eternal souls and life after death, some eternal heavenly place, or the alternative that people don't believe in so much because we're Americans, we're good people, we're not going to hell. Anyway, back to this inquiry of question after question, it seems that somewhere in that the perspective shifted to a deeper and deeper, more radical seeing that what appear to be things aren't. They don't have enough thingness to be what we seek or want. That's a bummer. Because we've been investing a lot in certain things, including, you know, meditative experiences and insights and going on retreat, having a beautiful experience, all of which is valuable, but we turn them into things. And then we turn ourselves into the possessor, owner, haver of things that were born. And, you know, we're back into caught up in birth, aging, illness, and death, and so on. Oops, I just jumped ahead and left out part of what I wanted to talk about, so I'll come back to where I just was a little later. So the Buddha was questioning, and it led him out of the dominant beliefs, assumptions of his time, the dominant spiritual paradigm and answer started to fall apart for him. But he was still largely using terminology of that time. Now I'd like to, after talking about what I call the Bodhisattva's big question, I'd like to ask, what's our big question? First, individually, and probably for tonight we'll leave it at the individual level, I have doubts that our culture anymore has any shared big question. We're way too fragmented, probably. Does the Bodhisattva's big question, what is the escape from birth, aging, illness, and death, does that move us? Does that light a fire under our practice? Is that something we wake up with and come back to? If not, then what is our big question? In this culture, this society, a world of climate change, of NSA basically having access to anything that's become information about us, what is our big question? And you know, there's this stuff we're all, like climate change, that's going on for all of us, and then each of us has the particular circumstances and details of our lives. So I'd like to pose to you, what is your big question? Some of the questions that drive us or move us might be spoken. We may have thought about them. We may have picked them up from a source such as the Buddha. But often the questions that drive us are unspoken, maybe not very well examined, and therefore not very well articulated. If we go back to the quests and pursuits that aren't so noble, but updating a little bit, is our fundamental question about security. For some of us, healthcare, health insurance is, or how we're going to finance retirement, these are big questions. They're ones I face as well. But how are we going to manage health insurance or health care and retirement and all that? Is that the big question? Or is it a question that is still caught up in that which is subject to aging, corruption, death, and the like? Are we seeking comfort? I know I have a strong pull towards comfort, convenience. Is how to be more comfortable, how to feel good about myself. I'm not saying it's a bad question, by the way. But is it a big question that can really lead our lives? What kind of stuff do I need? That might be some of the less spoken. We may not always want to cop to it. Or at least, you know, I was a monk for many years, so I know you're not supposed to want a lot of stuff. Doesn't mean I don't. At least certain stuff. Or knowledge, even. Acquiring knowledge. What do I need to know? So whether articulated and spoken or inarticulated and maybe somewhat murky, what are the questions we ask of life and ourselves, or even of meditation? And what are we pursuing with those questions? Do these questions, whatever they may be, and it's possible it's going to take some digging around to get more clarity. I've been digging with this for a while. do our questions have adequate depth and power? Like, comfort, in myself at least, once I'm comfortable, the motivation, you know, I'm not saying, well, I'll skip the tangent on that, but once I'm comfortable, I tend to just indulge in the comfort. And so making that a major pursuit doesn't seem to me to have much spiritual mileage, the way the Buddha's question did for him. Some people I've talked with about this have phrased their question in terms of compassion or love. And to me that probably has got more mileage than comfort. Although for some of us, part of love is comfort. But it seems to me there can be more. So I'm betting that there are various other ways of expressing big questions that can have lots of depth and power. So I'm not suggesting we all have to buy into the way the Buddha put it. But I do think it's valuable to explore what are the questions that are moving us and how deeply and strongly do they move us. According to Buddhism, the Buddha's question took him all the way as he understood it. He came to something, although it's not a thing, the way things seem to be. But he came to something that was not subject to birth, aging, illness, corruption, violence, and death. He claimed. And that's been at the core of the teaching that followed from that discovery or awakening. So what are our questions? And how much staying power, how much do they move us, how consistently, how deep do they go? I'd like to conclude by coming back to the shift in perspective that I started to mention a while ago by inquiring into the things called aging and death, by asking, well, how do those happen? How did that, and how does that happen? That and that and that. There's a shift from seeing things that kind of exist sort of by themselves to seeing, can still call them things because our language is limited. The Pali word is dhammas, which can be translated as things or phenomena. There are these phenomena that are conditioned. So another term is translated by conditioned things. Rather than separate individual things, there are conditioned things. But if we look into conditioned things, maybe even drop the word thing, and the shift is to see processes. That's a modern word. A word from a pre-modern word, though, would be streams. Instead of seeing things, there are streams. And in these streams, there's as much influence and relating influencing and relating as there are any separate or fixed thing. I mean, this is a radical change because we're so used to remembering ourselves and others and things in our lives. You know, they were like this yesterday, or so-and-so was like blah, blah, blah last week, last month, last year. It's just the default that there are these things that are more or less the same. Yeah, we know they change, but we keep assuming something that stays the same, which are, in the Buddha's time, atma, essences that don't change. And the shift in perspective was that the thingness of phenomena softened and became so transparent that what stood out was that their processes or streams of what the Buddha eventually called dependent co-arisen phenomena, streams of dependent co-arisen phenomena. Or some translators use the term dependently originated phenomena. So the questions, it seems to me, never led to an answer. And this to me is brilliant because much of Buddhist history has been about, okay, now we've got the Buddha's answer. He was brilliant and we got the answer, and now, you know, sometimes that's, people were very content to have that answer. In others, it's more, well, no, we've got his method. But I think, and if we pick up some answers and hold them very loosely, that might not be a problem, and methods can be very valuable. But I think what we're aiming for is not an answer or even a solution. But by inquiring the way the Bodhisattva did, a shift. And of course, some of that inquiry happens in meditation, if that's how we meditate. But there has to be this noble quest, this looking. Well, this is because of this, and this is because of that, and keep examining this until there's a shift that rather than fixed things, a fixed me doing this or experiencing this, that both the seen and the seer start to soften and become transparent, and what are seen are flows or streams of phenomena that arise out of each other. And there's no fixed point or essence to any of that. That can be scary for some because we want to believe there's some core essence. And some religions and spiritual teachings teach that with great fervor. But that's not what the Buddha's story is about. And so his question that was earlier phrased in terms of escape from dukkha, I prefer to speak of freedom from dukkha, freedom from all the stuff that's encumbered by birth, aging, corruption, violence, and death. That by seeing all this are streams of dependent co-arising that may look like things, and there may be kind of a very provisional, conventional ownership in a very makes me escape, because the old assumption is, boils down to, what's my escape or my Atman's escape? But in this shift in seeing, there's nobody left to be born, to age, to die. There's nobody to escape. And that seems to me the, could call it an answer, but I think that becomes a trap. Because it's not in having the answer. It's not like, you know, Buddhism is a cheat sheet that's gonna give you the answer and now you can go pass your test. It's not just the methods. It's the methods with the right spirit animated by a quest and the question. So I may have jumped the gun a bit and slipped in some of what many Buddhists, including myself, take to be the answer. But I hope that doesn't distract from our own quest and finding the powerful question that can keep us looking in a way that the shift in seeing can occur. So that concludes my prepared reflections. We have about a half an hour to go to lunch. So I'm prepared to take questions, but I'd like also to hear if you've got inklings about what your big questions might be. Not the, you know, they're the ordinary questions like my wife and I are waiting for the website, whatever.gov to work so we can explore a few things on that. So that's a important question, but what are the big questions? Because even if they fix it and I get some good health insurance, and I've already got good insurance, but it may not last. So, but that's not going to solve the big dilemma. So, floor is open. Yes.
The first thing that comes to mind is, you know, what's the purpose of me in my life? I don't know if this answers to what you're talking about, but I mean, I think that's the first thing that comes to mind is a question of comfort. I mean, if I have some answer to that, a lot of these other things will fall into place.
Yeah.
Issue of security, comfort, and that is less of an issue if I have a purpose and reason to live.
Right, and so how do you have a way of seeing what that purpose is?
Well, that's something that seems to be evolving, I think.
Seems to me it's a little...
It is evolving.
Okay, good. Well, it doesn't have to answer to me.
No.
It needs to answer to you.
Right. But it's in the category of the question that you're talking about.
It could be.
Could be.
Yeah. I mean, personally, I think it is, but what matters is that it works in you with adequate depth and power. Because it's possible to have these questions and just kind of play with them. Read a lot of books.
One of the things, the questions I have is, how do I become an instrument for the escape? How do I help others, myself?
So then you're still interested in the Buddhist framework of escape, liberation from dukkha. And not just for your own sake.
The psychologist, the word escape is just a double thing. Because escape is our first motivation. It's the motivation of the anima. It is from all life escapes. From what is conscious, what is distressing. That's the nature of life.
To survive.
Then you have to escape whatever is pain. There are some escapes that are better than others.
Right. Some aren't very good at all. The escape is so short.
The race is hot.
Yeah. And the dig. Yes.
My question is that is it necessary to be able to articulate what drives you to do things? But sometimes when it comes to self practice, sometimes it just, it's like a something that drives you. Necessarily know what it is, or maybe it is out of curiosity, like, or maybe reflection on the way you happen to be quoted about things that, oh, there's something higher, like, what satisfaction in us, worldly desire, and out of curiosity, take a practice to see what they're saying is true, because if there's something better, then maybe. That might answer one of your, life. there's here in America, we're so lucky to have almost everything we need for the material in your life. There's something in fact that sometimes people, you don't necessarily can articulate, and that sort of drive you to, explore other people's ideas. I don't know, is it better or to be able to articulate how you want to develop? See it so that it will move your practice a little bit more, or just do what feels or what moves to you?
Well, one, you are articulating something. In what you've said, there's some articulation. You mentioned dissatisfaction, seeking something higher or better. So you've got some articulation. You spoke it, so that was enough. That was some articulation. So I'm just mirroring, reflecting that back. I'm believing that, yes, to articulate, if it's grounded in self-awareness and practice and not just some theory we found somewhere, but if coming out of practice and reflecting on our practice, using our cognitive intellectual abilities to think about practice as well, then finding an appropriate amount of articulation to clarify for ourselves what we're doing, why, is it actually moving in the direction we seek? So maybe we're operating on instinct or a hunch, or it feels right. But those can be led astray. I'm not saying they are, but they can. And so to keep looking and reflecting and examining is part of practice. But that will happen at each person's own speed. So I'm not saying you have to make articulating this your priority and put everything else aside. That would probably be disastrous. But I'm saying this is part of the mix.
My question is for you. So what did the Buddha say? It's a little deceiving. I don't think I didn't find it as clear. So, and I mean, yes.
The common phrasing would be the Noble Eightfold Path or the Middle Way, which is in the framework of the four ennobling realities, or so-called noble truths. There's dukkha, origin, dukkha, end of dukkha, or quenching dukkha, and then path of practice leading to the quenching of dukkha. That, and then that's usually parsed as the Noble Eightfold Path.
Ask the question a little bit. So I've been taking notes, and I was just wondering, finding what Buddha found when he was meditating was a lot of, I thought it was a lot of nothing, not things, conceptual things, but nothingness, and there's something or some sort of But you brought up another word tonight that I hadn't heard before, which was the essence that he found. And I'm trying to figure out, is the essence the soul? Or is he actually, was there another word for the soul?
No, he, his time believed in those essences. He did. So his teaching was on Atman. Atman is a Sanskrit word. So Atman is that there is some essential core that lasts. And his conclusion in seeing everything as streams, that in everything we experience, no Atman can become. So no essential unchanging core can become. And another name, the standard term for that is anatta in the Pali language, not self. All this stuff is not self. And it's also spoken of as emptiness. Nothingness in Buddhist teachings has a different meaning. It's kind of a nihilism. So in Buddhist terms, there's all this, but it's empty of essence.
Human up here.
Everyone. Yep.
Yeah, it's a comforting idea that there's some essence that I truly am. But deep down, Buddhist teachings, you can't locate what that essence is, even though we often cling to the idea that there's gotta be. But you can't pinpoint it. And so the Buddha's solution was, forget about it. It's not He didn't see it as pragmatically useful.
That ocean of the soul, he just really didn't talk about that at all. And the Plato era stuff, he didn't.
No, he wasn't Greek. That's part of our dilemma. We come out of a Judeo-Greek, you know, Judeo-Christian, Neoplatonic cultural history. And then we're kind of mixing in stuff that comes out of India, which is different. And we're trying to translate. Even as much of our culture drops large parts of the Judeo-Christian Greek stuff. But in making that translation, part of it is, what do you mean by soul? It's possible I can just say, oh yeah, there's no soul. But in Western history, including Christianity, the word soul, the meaning of the word has changed a lot. It used to include the body. For example, in official Catholic doctrine, the soul was the whole human being, including the body. And many people now don't think that. And there have been a variety of changing ideas about the soul, as there was about the Atman in India. And the Buddha's response is defining it, not really the issue. So if you mean soul in a kind of loose, open way for what's really meaningful in human life, the capacity to love, no problem. But if you try to turn that into some fixed thing, then you won't have a problem. Because it ain't a fixed thing. And then trying to fix it traps it. It would stagnate. That's at least how I read these things. Yes?
I didn't like that escape idea at all. And I don't know. Right. And again, what I'm saying is language is such a trap all the way. And I was thinking, okay, what's the question? Well, the question is escape. The question is optimal participation. So I don't know, maybe I've got some error in my process here, but to me, like Bhagavad Gita said, I seem to be a verb, and a verb is not a thing or a permanent or anything else. And I think that's our language problem, is we're trying to think if there's an essence or a soul and all that stuff, but it's the wrong question.
Yeah, I mean, personally, it works for me that shifting away from nouns to more verbs. And English is a noun-heavy language, I've read.
And the word process seems to be a word in English that gets us out of that noun business.
Mm. It helps, but we've got to keep seeing it too, not just talking it. And I think it's good to recognize when a word like escape can have connotations we're uncomfortable with. But as the gentleman pointed out, we still spend a lot of time escaping. And the problem isn't the word. Although I know I waste a lot of time reacting to certain words that I've judged in some way. So I don't want to start, blaming the word thing. That's our problem. We've got things and nouns, so I'm not going to use those words anymore. Yes, and then?
I had an interesting example today. I thought when you talked about the suffering thing. The house, and I caught myself in the mirror and saw these little jowls. And just in a moment, I was like, oh, jowls. But I didn't suffer about that as much as I suffered about my first few gray hairs. I just think that the practice has made me so much less identified. You know, like identified with what I am physically. There was a time when I was great about remembering names, but I was stellar. That's not, but I don't suffer about it as much anymore. And I think that's really part of the practice about not identification. It's always changing. And that moment tonight when I just had that vowel and just also thought, and I'm not suffering as much as I used to about that. And I really think that that's kind of what the practice is about, the things that at one time I was so, this is really, really invested in, and I just doesn't have that grip anymore, and I really see that I suffer less.
And I think it's partly the not identifying so much, but also say, we can turn aging into this abstract enemy. Instead of, okay, there's this aging process, and here's a piece of it, a sign of it. But to see it, okay, accept it as process of life. And that's, you know, we want to be alive and not age. Well, sorry, it's just not how it works. And so there's also, I think, some shift in seeing these things not as a problem where we've sort of separated out there, and then we can try to avoid it, escape it.
What our focus is.
What's your big question?
Big question, yeah. Well, for me, it's to understand more and more how the interconnectedness of things ultimately means this one thing. You know, I mean, I have glimpses of it, and I really believe it. so that's where I want, where I would like to go, to really be able to be present in the now, understanding that, you know, the causal effect of everything, how me in this body has an effect on that, but that you in this body isn't really separate from anybody else or the world or anything else. And had kind of an interesting ongoing experience with my mother, who I saw her today, and she has Alzheimer's. And so things that I think that especially maybe us in this culture identify with one of our big possessions is history. You know, what we've accomplished, the people we know, the things we've done, all of this stuff that has a lot to do with prestige and all this. And for my mother, all that's disappearing. And along with that, I'm disappearing. So now I'm her sister, and even though she knows that she loves my name and this and that, she'll keep on referring to me as her sister and asking about things I don't know anything about. All that. So our history's been stripped away, so that really all we have is the now. That's all I have with her now. And it's just kind of made me realize that's all I have for anybody. You know, she's just kind of brought that to the surface. So I can suffer because she doesn't remember me up. My child is gone. It's no more, you know. But it never was, you know. It's in the past where it belongs. So, you know, when I come to peace with that, I can really be present for her. And that's kind of helping me be present in other situations.
Yeah, whatever relationship can happen today can happen if you're not trying to define it by the past relationship.
Yeah.
And past identities like daughter, mother.
And I want to go back to the question a little bit. So, the goal is to be in the now and to be non-self, but connected to self. Without a soul, why would you choose to do so? Because it's a, I think, like this, it's like, why would I want to get to a place where I didn't have to? Why would I need to go from non-self to have a soul? That's kind of hard. In my brain, it's kind of looking for all that else. So, and then part B would be is that in Buddhist practice, what would be the closest thing to what within it the soul is for?
I would not say that being in the now is the goal. And being not self is not the goal, because if we make them goals, I think it doesn't work. Now, being present to what's going on now is, that's actually not a Buddhist teaching. It's a pop Buddhist teaching in North America that comes as much from the Transcendentalists. And there's a monk in San Diego, Tenisaro, who's written a very good article on Buddhist romanticism, and another one, I forget the title, on a lot of the kind of Emersonian transcendental ideas that have been incorporated in Buddhism when they don't actually fit that well. So, being present to what's going on with our bodies, feelings, thoughts, is important to be able to inquire what's going on. But the word mindfulness, it's often left out that mindfulness can be about the past. Mindfulness is to bring something to mind. And so, when we're doing certain mindfulness practices, we're taking the breath or what's happening right now. But in other practices, mindfulness, like in metta, loving kindness practice, we use memory, imagination, thought to evoke loving kindness. So we bring it to mind. And that can use memory. So being in the present has an important role, but it's not the goal. And not self is a concept. And what I was trying to get at tonight, at least at the end, is the Bodhisattva's quest became not looking for the answer that was figured out, but the kind of radical inquiry that led to a shift in how he saw experience. And so I'm personally have been fascinated by the not-self teaching for a long time now. How many years is it? 30, maybe 32. But you know, so I'm familiar with it intellectually, but that's not really the point. It's not like we're going to get the answer, and once we've got the answer, then we're going to get to it somehow. It's more about the process, the journey. So I think it's good enough just to know, okay, the Buddha talked about not self, which means the word atta, if it's translated self, means a separate individual entity that has agency and control. That's a little bit philosophically worked out beyond what he actually said, but the way he talked about it, not self means you can't find anything that doesn't change. You can't find anything that has absolute power over itself or other things, and so on. So we can come at it intellectually, but it's really about the inquiry into dukkha, or some other big question. That inquiry that leads us to see, oh, it's processes rather than fixed, separate things. And your second question was about soul?
How would that be described? Is there a closest?
I don't know, because I don't know what the hell the word means. So, I live in a country where people talk about God, soul, and heaven, and most people cannot give any clear expression what those words mean. I know God exists. Okay, what is God? The Creator. Tell me more. You can't. And soul, people assume there's a soul. What does it mean? To come back to articulation, some of these important terms, we need to have some clarity what the hell we're talking about, or we're just kind of flailing around. So, first you have to say what soul means for me to link it up with Buddhist teachings.
Well, my first step would be, and I thought about this would be, like loving energy. That's kind of, that's actually struggling.
Well, Buddhism talks about compassion and metta, kindness, friendliness. But it doesn't call it the soul, kind of. It doesn't frame it as this. Buddhism wouldn't say compassion is going to go to heaven for eternity. But compassion is a powerful part of the journey. And in this perspective, anything, insight, wisdom, mindfulness, none of these operate as the answer. The Buddhist, the serious, you know, explored Buddhist perspective is there are all these factors working together. And within that, there's learning, there's compassion, there's dedication, there's effort. There's humility. But none of these are fixed. It's a shifting terrain. But these things, there's a bunch of factors that tend to reinforce each other. And a certain momentum develops. But nobody owns it. Nobody's controlling it. It can fall apart and it can kind of pick up, the pieces can come back together, but it's always a new configuration. And the configuration is never static. It's a lot of words, but some of us like words. I do. One more.
I'm really like, I'm on the same page with you as far as the soul. I think a lot of people use that as an abstract representation of everything that's supposed to be cast like that. Some people call it heart, some people call it soul, some people call it heart and soul. I rather like that. I'm not practicing Buddhist or anything like that. It's the first time I've been to something like that. But I, as far as a lot of faith, or whatever you call it faith, I really like that about that. I like that viewpoint on it. And as far as a question, I'm somewhat of a nerd, so this is going to be a little nerdy, but, you know, with Dookie, you talk about agents being part of that, because that's really one of the big questions. And, you know, we map human genome, we have rats in labs that have lived 14 generations longer than they're supposed to. And I personally think
the same rat.
Yeah. Oh yeah. They've mapped out the human gene that, yeah, your body reproduces itself every 10 years. Your body is brand new, completely replicates, but it's like a photocopy. So meaning that for 10 years, you're speaking of photocopy and photocopy and photocopy, which is, you know, like anybody that's done that sees the quality of photocopies. And I think we're maybe 4 generations by the most from learning how to flip that switch. So what happens when you remove aging from that? And, you know, and you kind of remove a natural death, you know, excluding illness and whatnot, from it, or a 1,000-pound acne weight falling on your head. You know, what do you, where does it go? How would that change that viewpoint for this?
Okay. Briefly, come back when we've actually got there, because we've been speculating about those things for a while, and I'm skeptical. Second, if they can, I mean, I think basically Buddhist teachings would say it ain't gonna happen. It's something weird will come out of it. So maybe we live a long, long time, but it's gonna be duped up. And second, words like aging and death are also powerful metaphors. So I don't read them like birth. I don't think the birth that's dukkha is primarily physical birth. So I'm not saying these words don't have their literal meanings, but that's not their only meaning. So there's an aging and death to everything. A relationship, a phone call, a good meal. Every time you conceive of yourself, I'm blah, 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 there's a birth and an aging and death. And a powerful place to see this are in the more destructive emotions like fear, anger, greed, envy. Can see that process.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.